From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and this is a show where we deal with mental health issues from a holistic perspective, which means creating a balance in body, mind, and spirit. Now, we all know that the truth will set you free, but the question we ask on this show is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? Before I get into today's topic, or even tell you what it is, I want to read a email that I received from Dan G. in Phoenix, and he's a listener who heard me one day about a month or two ago, and he writes, "Anyway, your radio show was also interesting because I never received dating tips from a gay man. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It was just different but true. It actually made me look at gay relationships in a more warm and sympathetic way, if that makes sense. To be quite honest, I guess I never realized that when someone is gay, they would have the same struggles in a relationship as folks that are not. To me, that's the essence. I was actually thrilled to get that email from him because I know that there are listeners out there who understand that what this show is about is mental health issues, that I'm a therapist, that I'm here to help people stimulate their thinking and maybe stimulate change and growth in their lives, and that I also happen to be a gay man, and that that is not the primary part of who I am. It is an aspect of who I am that I think informs and feeds my sensitivities and my consciousness and brings a certain set of experiences to who I am as a therapist, but also who I am as a human being. That's not to say that because of that I'm any better or worse a therapist, and of course there'd be people out there that may argue that one way or the other. But the point is that the focus of the show is that we're all human and that we all have similar struggles and similar challenges, and that none of us, and especially as a therapist, you know, we're taught unconditional positive regard for what we're hearing from our clients. And to me, it's the essence of how we all need to live as human beings. So if you were listening a couple of weeks ago, since this is Gay Pride Month around the country, I've done a couple of shows this month specific to the GLBT community, and for those of you who don't know what those initials mean, that's gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender. A couple of weeks ago, I did a show on religion and homosexuality, and my guest was the writer and director of Latter Days, C.J. Cox, who I know here in L.A. And in the introduction and the announcement that I sent out, I said that Latter Days is a film about a Mormon missionary on assignment in Los Angeles. His main character meets a West Hollywood pretty boy and is forced to look inward to reconcile his repressed sexuality with his Christian teachings and beliefs. That phrase, Christian teachings and beliefs related to the Mormon Church, was a faux pas on my end, and I got an email from actually a friend of mine here in Los Angeles named Morgan Summer, who's involved with a periodical called CyberSocket, which deals with websites and web information and stuff specifically related to the GLBT community, and himself a former Mormon. So I always believe in learning, and I want to share that learning and pass it on, and I stand corrected thanks to Morgan, and I promised him I would read this on the air. And he says, "Hi, Stuart, the main character of Latter Days is not dealing with his Christian teachings and beliefs. He is specifically dealing with Mormon dogma and Mormon cultural issues that are an intrinsic consequence, part of Mormon theology and Mormon history. These beliefs and cultural standards are most certainly not recognized by mainstream Christianity. I am a seventh-generation Mormon. The issues that gay Mormons face are similar to those of gay Christians, but rooted in theories and philosophies and a culture that are unique. Christians do not recognize Mormons as members of their faith group, and really Mormons do not consider themselves part of that group either. So I thank Morgan for that correction and for a little chance to learn something and clarify my own knowledge, and hopefully I won't apply those same things in the future. And to me, that's what living's about. It's about being willing to stand corrected when you say something or believe something that is not, well, it may be something you truly do believe based on the information that you've had up till now or the imprinting that you've lived through. To me, the whole purpose of therapy is to help people open their consciousness, open their hearts, and open their minds to consider different ways of thinking and different ways of being and different ways of perceiving who they are in the world and what the world is about that surrounds them, and how to integrate that, how to live more powerfully and more confidently and with more love and passion for all people, men, women, gay, straight, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, whatever. And I think with that essence and that foundation built into more of us, I think there would be a lot less of the fighting and insanity that we see going on in the world, and to be honest with you, a lot less of the negativity that even goes out over the airwaves. So with all that being said, I remind all of you that this is a live call-in show. We are live today, as opposed to last week, since I was at a conference. And the number in the Phoenix area is area code 480-949-1310. That's 480-949-1310. And if you're listening via the internet, if you're outside the Phoenix area, if you connected through my website, Tell the Truth Faster, or via KXAM site, it's still the same number. It's a toll call for you, 480-949-1310. And it's not all that expensive to call into Phoenix, so if you want to participate or ask a question, please do. Now, with all that being said, I want to introduce my guest today and follow up on my gay pride focus. And today's topic happens to be the title of a book that came out in the last year, and it's titled 10 Smart Things Gay Men Can Do to Improve Their Lives. That's the title of a book written by a clinical social worker, Joe Court, who's in the Detroit area, suburb of Detroit, and practices up there, and is very well written and has written extensively for a lot of different magazines, and I've read a number of his articles online, and I'm very pleased to have you here today. Joe, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
The reason I started out with that quote from that email really was because it really brought home the fact that there are people who are out there who will listen to today's show who are not gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender, and can hear these 10 smart things that gay men can do to improve their lives. And I know that you're writing specifically to help elevate the consciousness of gay men in our communities, but from reading your book, it's clear and evident to me that most of these, if not all of them, can be applied across the board, gay or straight, lesbian, bisexual, it doesn't really matter. These are really 10 smart things people can do to improve their lives. And I love the way you focused it in on gay men, because there's very little literature out there for gay men or lesbians in particular in terms of their own healing process. So I thank you for doing that.
And thank you.
Is your practice strictly with gay men, or do you work with the whole community out there?
You know, I work with the whole community. It's probably a higher percentage. I probably have 65% gays and lesbians, and then 35% heterosexual. And the way that heterosexuals find me is I specialize with sexual addiction, and I specialize with couples therapy called Imago Relationship Therapy, and so they end up coming to me through that door and then realize I'm gay when they come in, and it's just not an issue for most people that come through. But I want to definitely come back to what you said. I've had straight people read my book and say that I should write the book and do it for 10 smart things people can do. And I thought about it because it's true. Even the coming out chapter, everyone in their life has to come out of something, as you and I both know, as therapists,
right.
You know? And so I have thought about it. It's just a time thing, and I really, like you said, wanted it for gay men who have, we have such little things out there for our community.
The issue of coming out, there's two things I want to get right into, actually. Since you brought up the word imago counseling,
yep.
I want to explain that because I think it's going to be integrated into more of a conversation.
Okay.
But the very issue of coming out is really the essence of telling the truth faster, which is, you know, the basic theme of my show and most of my work is, you know, tell the truth faster. That's where the empowerment comes from. And coming out is for gay men coming out of the closet, or like you say, and I say this all the time also, in reading your stuff, I see where we're extremely compatible in a lot of our approaches and philosophies, that coming out is about owning your truth about anything that you've been struggling with and have shame around.
Yes, it's so true.
So tell us about imago therapy. I actually attended a workshop with Waverly Farrell here in Los Angeles many months ago, which was kind of like a three-hour introduction to it. But briefly, what is imago?
Sure, yeah. I love Waverly, by the way. I know her. Imago is a word. It's Latin for image, and it was coined, imago relationship therapy was coined by Dr. Harville Hendricks, and it's based on two parts. One is that you're drawn, basically that you're drawn to familiar love. So you, when you're scanning a room looking for the perfect mate, whether you're gay or straight, you're looking for someone unconsciously who has the positive and negative traits of the people who raised you, your primary caretakers, mother, father, or whoever. That's part one of it. And part two is that you're looking, again, for familiar love, the part of you, the parts of you that aren't online, that had to be suppressed or buried as a kid because maybe your family said, we don't do anger in this family, we're not playful, don't be this way, don't be that way. Well, then you're drawn to people who are that way, who can express it, who weren't mm-hmm. taught that, and bring that part of you that was taught to be buried online.
So it's really about teaching people in this type of counseling, again, to tell the truth faster, to come out, so to speak, of those aspects that they were taught to repress,
yes.
and that really would be healthy and helpful aspects of who they are, and to really nurture those things.
For sure.
Okay.
And the reason I love imago therapy is that although it's Harville Hendricks is heterosexual and the book was written heterosexually, it's a people-oriented model. So it's not a male-female, male-male, female-female, where specific dynamics are very important, but he sort of says the bottom line is how are you going to relate to this other person. I love the name of your show. It really, he says marriage basically is therapy and helps you tell the truth faster, like you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, any relationship, as we all kind of see, is a classroom, no matter what it is, whether it's a primary intimate relationship, whether it's a friendship, whether it's someone you just met on the street, you know, often it is something that will make you take a look at yourself if you're conscious and open enough to do that instead of running from it.
For sure.
I'm trying to have a flow to this so that there's a sensibility, and I do want to get specifically to the 10 steps, or at least get through some of them on the show. But in reading your book and some of the materials from your website, there's an issue that actually is very close to my heart, and that is, talk a little bit about client-therapist matching. Some people really strongly believe if you're gay, you should really see a gay or lesbian therapist. If there are heterosexual therapists that are gay or lesbian friendly who will do the job. And tell me about your beliefs in terms of therapist-client matching.
Sure. I don't believe necessarily that somebody has to have a specific orientation or specific type of recovery. I know lots of people believe certain things about that in terms of matching. I think it's very personal. I do think this, though, and I teach this to both straight and gay therapists, that you're really doing a disservice to gays and lesbians if you're not out about who you are, gay or straight.
Mm-hmm.
Or more, I believe more in the humanistic approach, not that you reveal all of your problems and that you sit down and share inappropriately with clients, but we're a community as gays and lesbians who've been shunned from human contact and I think really traumatized, sort of being taught you don't belong and we don't want to hear from you and the contact's been ruptured. So as a therapist, it's so important that you not be a blank screen or just this mirror reflecting back throughout the hour, that you be willing to share some experiences, that if a client calls and says, I need to know if you're gay or straight, that is an important question to be answered.
That you don't return with, why is that important to you, or throw it back at them instead of really being honest about it.
Exactly, or maybe even doing that, but then being willing after you do that and they come up with their response to still reveal.
Mm-hmm.
Where a lot of therapists say, well, I don't do that, particularly on the phone call, and I say, well, then you're not going to get a lot of gay and lesbian clients because that's an important and pertinent question.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're gay or straight, it doesn't matter. But I do think there are benefits to being gay therapist or lesbian because you're modeling if you're out and not homophobic or working on your outness and homophobia.
Right. Just because someone's gay or lesbian doesn't mean, as a therapist, doesn't mean they don't have their own share of the homophobia, too.
Oh, my God. Sometimes it's worse. You're so right. So I mean, it's so important that anybody be working on that, but for sure, it really is a modeling if you're gay or lesbian. But the other side is, if you're a straight therapist, you're also modeling acceptance and providing something that gays and lesbians don't get from the heterosexist society.
Mm-hmm. Good. I mean, because I agree with that totally. And, you know, there are a lot of colleagues that I have who say you never self-disclose anything. You keep your objectivity and your distancing and keep it all focused on the client. I also believe, like you do, that when there's a relevancy to some self-disclosure, I think it's very important. Number one, they see me as a human and more of a work in progress myself.
Yep.
Instead of putting me up on a pedestal and assuming I have everything together, and anytime we do that in any relationship, we're going to be let down.
For sure. That, I agree with you.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about Imago. We're taught in the training to share some of our experiences that were difficult that we worked through. So while I don't sit there at a workshop or my client hour and share my current problems or my other issues that aren't my client's business, I will share with them, you know, my partner and I went through this, or this is normal. This, you know, most couples go through this. And then I'll share a little bit about it, and it makes them feel like we're all, like you said, on this journey together. I'm not elevated above them.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't, you know, and I do understand the respecting of boundaries and that there are therapists out there that wouldn't do that, and you and I probably both had clients come to you and say, oh, my therapist shared more about himself than I did.
Yes. Yeah, in fact, recently I had a client say, I couldn't keep going back to them. They were talking more about themselves than they were me.
So that's a good, that's healthy on his part. They left.
That's what I said to him. So let's kind of move beyond that and talk about the book itself. You know, you came down with, one thing I liked about the book also, is just like you're saying, is about humanizing. I think that people get more out of material like this when you humanize it. And the one thing I really liked about your book, or one of them, was the fact that you brought a lot of client anecdotal stuff in to make your points and to lead the reader into the issues, which almost makes for people who like reading novels or watching soap operas, it kind of, you're getting the point and you're getting the lessons a little bit easier to absorb and take in, I think, that way.
Oh,
and I like
your
writing because of that.
That's why I did it. I really, really wanted somebody to feel like, wow, I can relate, or I always wondered what someone like this went through, and then I wanted them to be able to see it rather than me just talking about it.
Mm-hmm. So how did you narrow it down to the 10 particular things that we're going to get into shortly?
Yeah, I found that I had clients coming to me over and over again for those same 10 kind of issues. You know, the coming out, the postponed adolescence, all of it, the sexual addiction particularly,
mm-hmm.
where and relationship issues. And I thought, you know, these are so important. I actually initially started doing workshops on all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a while, I had all these notes, and I thought, this would be really, really helpful, I think, if I could turn it into a book and if people wanted to read it in those areas where I weren't able to reach. And, you know, I've been really amazed and impressed and actually a little bit surprised that the book's done so well, because I didn't think I had much to say to people on the East and West Coast, like in L.A. and San Francisco. I really didn't. I thought...
You think we're that much different than Detroit?
I did. I thought, you know, and most people are writing from those areas, so they've got access to those writers. And when I was in San Francisco, I asked people, this group of gay men, why is my book selling so well at this one bookstore? And they said... me, because you have to remember, it's kind of like what you just said, we don't come from here, we come from places like where you are in Michigan, and we had unresolved issues that we never thought about until we read your book, and I never, ever thought about that.
But I also think it's a universality,
yes, yes.
I'm tripping over my tongue here, of these issues, and like I said, gay or straight, or no matter where you come from geographically, I was born and raised in New York, I lived in South Florida for 11 years, I've been in L.A. for 16 years, and in the three places I've lived, like you're saying, most people don't come from those places, I mean, except New Yorkers are born and raised very often, but it's still a very cosmopolitan international city. South Florida is a city, is an area of transients and newcomers, and L.A. certainly is that. And the gay male community in particular, and I know it's true for lesbians, tended to find safety in geographic areas where there were people of similarity, other gay men or lesbians and stuff, and they usually did leave home in order to find that.
It makes so much sense.
Mm-hmm. So, the first one is take responsibility for your own life, which to me, like I said, is like a cornerstone of what therapy is about. I mean, it's lesson number one in life.
Yeah.
You know, instead of playing the victim, instead of blaming everybody else for your woes and sorrows, I mean, I've seen people well into their 60s and 70s still doing that.
Isn't that sad?
How do you move people from the blame game and the victim consciousness into taking that responsibility?
Yeah, this one was this is a big stickler for me because of so many reasons. I actually come from a family where people do not take responsibility for their own lives or their own accountability, and it's really upsetting. I think that's probably why I became even a therapist, to help everybody, you know, do that. But particularly gays and lesbians, when they come in and they say, my family, you know, and my workspace and my friends should be asking me questions and helping me come out, and I shouldn't have to, you know, do this on my own, and I shouldn't have to educate them and stop them. And I say, that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
You absolutely have to be the one to push this through, because most people, they don't know. I know this is more in the coming out chapter, but it's also in the first part where I teach people, as you probably do, people don't know what to say, they don't know what to do often. It's not they're trying to be mean or hurtful. They just don't know how to help you or what to ask.
Right.
And so, but if it is a cornerstone, this first chapter is pretty much universal, like you said. It really is about people coming in and realizing that if they're going to keep waiting for their partner to change or their family to change or society to change, they're not getting anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be waiting a long time.
Right.
And so the work I was doing, as I do probably with every single client, as you probably do, is let's talk about how you're going to make this happen and not wait for so-and-so to do it for you.
Right. In other words, what are you unhappy about with yourself, and are you willing to take responsibility for making the changes you need to make, irresponsible of whether your partner or family members are willing to take the journey with you?
Exactly. And in fact, when couples come in the very first session, I say, all right, now I'd like you to talk about to the one partner what you do to contribute to the conflict, and then I say to the other partner the same thing, and they're ready to tell me all the things the other one does that contribute.
I do the same thing. It's like, let's make a self-responsibility list instead of sitting and pointing fingers at the other. And it usually shocks the living daylights out of them. It's like, huh? But it's usually one of the most powerful lessons for them, because most of them start coming up with things that it never even dawned on them before, and they haven't been willing to own, and yet the list starts flowing from them.
Exactly.
Once they're willing to start that list, they're shocked at how much that they do see in themselves that they're contributing. And it really is a good way to kind of break the constant attacking cycle.
And it does.
Yeah.
You're right.
Mm-hmm. So the second one is, I know we're going to go through these briefly. We kind of talked about this one, affirm yourself by coming out. And again, that has to do with anything, whether it's about being gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender, or coming out because you really don't want to be an attorney and you want to be an artist, or
exactly.
or coming out by saying, you know, it's like, you know, I want to move to another area of the country. You know, there are a lot of things that people are not dealing with. Or coming out by saying, I don't want to continue our poverty consciousness of this family. I'm going out to make some money.
Exactly.
You know, in other words, I'm going to break with the unspoken laws of this family.
And which is exactly what coming out is all about with the gays and lesbians.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I did the second chapter was I really felt like people didn't understand that, and I would educate even therapists, even gay therapists, about the stages. And the stages that I use, Vivian Cass's model, she's not the only model, but I like her model the best. It's not that I dislike the other models, but I felt like hers was more universal. And it really helps gay people when they're in my office, particularly when they're in stage five, which I always call the gay adolescence, you know.
Uh-huh.
Like, we don't get to do it as teens, so we're doing it in our later years when we're coming out, and sometimes that's when you're 50, 60, 70.
Mm-hmm.
You're wearing these gay pride shirts and paying with a gay credit card, and even they feel shamed. Like, I don't know why I'm doing this, but I'm compelled to, you know, be in people's faces about it. And that's really just a stage, and it needs to be understood and normalized that, you know, when you're a teenager, it's adults against teens, and you separate yourself. When you're in stage five of coming out, it's gays against straights, and you're separating yourselves to create your own identity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's helped a lot of my clients kind of relax around it.
Well, one of the things, and it's as a talk show host, I also believe, I mean, people who've listened to me regularly or listened to my archives will hear a lot about who I am and my life and my family and my journey and stuff, and I believe I can, you know, bring things more into focus if I'm talking on a more personal level. But one of the things that I often have said about the coming out stuff is most of us that have struggled with this for a long time internally assume that as soon as the people who love us know, we're going to be rejected and abandoned and judged, and people are going to get angry with us. And I know in college when I started my coming out process and telling friends and finally came out to family, it's like, nobody was getting angry with me and nobody was rejecting me. And you know what? It started really getting me angry. Because I'd invested so much assuming that that's the way it would be and so much time and energy defending myself against that inevitability that when it didn't happen, it was like I got angry with the process and with these
people.
You were
prepared for it.
Say again?
You were prepared for it, it sounds like, and it just never happened.
Exactly. And what most people wish that would happen was people saying, well, I kind of knew, or it doesn't matter to me, or whatever, and even talking to my parents about it when I was 21, it was life-altering, it was freeing, it was lifting a weight off of me, but I also had to take into effect that, especially with my parents, I'd been dealing with this for years internally, even though I hadn't been out yet. They're just now beginning to deal with it. And a lot of people get very impatient with their parents.
Yes.
and project that anger onto them instead of giving them the time and the patience and maybe a couple of years' worth of it.
Yes.
to process this information and to become familiar and comfortable with it.
You're so right. I totally agree.
So with the coming out stuff, is there anything else you want to say about that? I know in less than an hour we're not going to get into depth, so we could spend a whole hour on any one of these.
Yeah, I know.
Is there any other major point or thing you want to get across to people in terms of the coming out issue?
Just that stage five is out of the six is so important to me, that gay adolescence and sort of understanding it's just a stage. And the first few stages, I for therapists particularly, I teach that, you know, it's really important that some people, when they're in those beginning stages, they don't know if they're homosexual. They don't even use the word gay. They don't know if they've been sexually abused. They don't know if they're just bi or a little kinky. I mean, there's a million things that go on for people in the beginning. And often therapists will stay away from, well, maybe you're gay. Have you thought about that? That can be an option, too, because they're afraid they're going to shame the client or confuse the client, and I don't agree with that.
Right, I agree.
Right? I think everybody should have the option and permission to explore all of those things.
Right. Okay, we're going to go on to the next one, but we're going to take a short break here, Joe. And to my listeners, stay tuned. This is Stuart Altshuler at KXAM in Phoenix. We Tell the Truth Faster. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Welcome back to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler, a licensed marriage and family therapist. And you're listening to KXAM in Phoenix, and it's a live call-in show. The number is 480-949-1310. If you want to call in with a question or a comment with my guest today, Joe Court, who his most recent book, I believe, is the book we're talking about today, 10 Smart Things Gay Men Can Do to Improve Their Lives. And, Joe, we were going through those 10 items as we were progressing, and like I said at the opening of the show, your book could be 10 smart things people can do to improve their lives, because all of the stuff apply to all of us. The third one is resolve issues with your family. Now, again, this is a cornerstone of most therapy.
Yes.
You know, I mean, who we are today is a composite and result of what we grew up with. And while I personally don't believe we have to invest all our time in analyzing every nook and cranny of our childhood the way psychoanalysis and some others might do, it's impossible to disconnect one from the other.
Right.
So talk a little bit about what that chapter is about in terms of resolving issues with your family.
Yeah, that one was important to me because I wanted people to, I sort of said it, but that I wanted them to not rush their family. It's like what you said. It takes sometimes a couple of years for them to get used to it and for them to understand, you know, I love what Peace-like says, when our children or our family members come out of the closet, we go immediately into the closet.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so it's a coming out for them, too, and there's lots of issues involved. But I really felt like, and I meant to say this about the coming out, that was a little different than other books have written. You know, I called it dust bunnies, that when you come out of the closet, you don't just have an orientation. You've buried a lot of other things in there, sort of like what we all have done. And so we have dust bunnies to deal with that are issues from our families, from our childhood, unresolved things. And so all the things that I talk about in the coming out chapter also apply in the family chapter. Because when someone comes out in a family, it forces honesty, it forces directness, and I think it was illustrated so great in that movie with Kevin Kline. In and Out.
In and Out.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
When the mother tells the other women, her friends, that her son is gay, and all of a sudden these other women start talking about the truths in their lives that they've never told. When that one woman says her husband has 3 testicles, if you remember,
uh-huh.
One laughs. It's like, it forces the family to have to be honest, and if they're not used to it or uncomfortable with it, the conflict or the dysfunction, I think, gets exaggerated and magnifies. And I teach people about that to understand that it's just normal. It's sort of like when you're in crisis, all the dysfunction magnifies.
Right.
So to expect it, understand it, and have a higher place around it to deal with it, not to fight it.
I think the other part of it is what we see very often with addictive processes in families, when all of a sudden the identified addict of the family gets into recovery, it has a ripple effect on the whole system that really sends everyone into a spiral very often, because the system liked the status quo. They liked having someone to blame for the woes, and they liked having not to take a look at their own responsibility for the system's patterns and things like that. And it's the same thing with this coming out thing about sexuality. Most of the family usually knows this, but nobody wants to say the words, and everybody says, as long as you, it's like don't ask, don't tell.
Exactly.
Type of thing. So as soon as the person comes out of the closet dealing with the sexuality or dealing with their addictive process or whatever, it sends everybody into having to redefine who they are, how they relate to one another or resisting that change, in which case it becomes that much more work for the identified person.
Exactly. And pretty much that is what I say in that chapter is to just, and even I kind of hope that even parents of gays and lesbians or family members would read my book and be able to read that chapter and help themselves navigate through that by what I wrote, because everyone's affected.
I think I told you over the phone when we talked, you know, one of the things that I do is I actually do counseling in 3 of the gay bathhouses here in L.A.
Oh, that's right.
And there's this one guy that's come in periodically to talk with me, and about 2 months ago, in fact, it was just before I got your email about coming on the show, like within a week or two, he lives up in Santa Barbara, so he doesn't get down to L.A. too often, so every time he does, he usually does it when he knows I'm going to be on shift, and I said, "You seem different." He said, "I read this life-altering book." And I said, "What is it?" He said, "It's called 10 Smart Things Gay Men to Do to Improve Their Lives."
Oh my God.
A guy named Joe Court.
Oh, that's so nice.
He said, "I read this book, and it changed my life."
Wow.
I know.
Thank you for telling me that. It always makes me feel good.
And well, we all need the feedback. And you're doing a service by writing any book, but particularly for the GLBT community. And I know he's on my email list. I'm hoping he's listening because I told him you were going to be on the show.
Oh, God.
So maybe he's listening and we may hear from him.
Well, if he is, thank you.
Okay.
No, really, I mean it.
Let's move on to one of my favorites, and I realize just now we're not going to get through all 10, which may intrigue enough people to go out and buy the book and find out what the rest of them are. Like if you want to know how the story ends, you have to read the book. Graduate from Eternal Adolescence.
Yep.
Now, I mean, we've seen the book, The Peter Pan Principle and things like that, where, you know, men have always been cubbyholed in terms of never wanting to grow up and whatever, but you apply this specifically to gay men, and I think there is some validity to this. So talk about that for a minute and where you think the foundation of that comes from.
Oh, for sure. I'll start with that last part just for a second, because I think it's a male issue. I don't think it's just gay male.
Right.
Because of my book, you know, and I do think there's something specific to our community as gay men, because the thing is this, men, even we just know this about children, that girls mature faster than boys. And when you're heterosexual and you're in relationship with a woman, I find this all the time in the couples I treat, the woman is usually, not always, but usually trying to pull the male, her male partner, into adulthood. You now have a family, you can't golf all the time, you can't party all the time, you know, whatever, you have children, you have this. But gay men, we don't have that. We don't have hardly anyone, unless our partners are more mature, there's something calling for maturity to bring us into it.
And yet sometimes it's the younger of the two that is the more mature.
Yeah, oh.
Okay, it's not necessarily age.
No.
Or about what's going on inside.
Very good point.
Yeah.
No, it's absolutely about your emotional maturity, not your age maturity. You're right. And so I have just seen so much of this where there's just it's just, there's like a teenage mentality, a teenage, you know, and this is reparative therapists love to point this out, as if it's only gay people, and we're stunted, and we're immature. But, you know, we're seeing with gay marriage, it's in those books they're saying over and over again, no, we're not even allowed into the adult fraternity. We're not even allowed to get married, for sake.
Or have kids.
Or have kids, or be honored about having kids, which all takes a mature stance. So I just sort of wanted to write about that. That was one of my most important chapters, too, to say, hey, we need to grow up a little bit. Not life isn't all a big party.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the opposite is true for the lesbians. When I'm on these gay cruises, there's a lesbian comic, and she says that she has more fun on the gay cruises because the lesbian cruise, she jokes, is so heavy and so everybody's so mature, it's no fun, you know. So there needs to be like a balance, you know.
Well, to me, that's the key, again, of my approach being holistic, is the word balance comes into my work with clients all the time. I think that is an essential aspect of our own growth process, is finding what our own balance is, and that's different for everyone.
Yes.
You know, and, you know, part of it is that when you're hiding yourself so much, that it's often like, you know, when someone starts doing drugs at age 14, and all of a sudden they're 30 years old and getting clean, they're feeling like they're still that 14-year-old because somewhere developmentally at 14, they started shutting down the ability to integrate the things that usually help people mature and develop. So they find themselves now in a 30-year-old body, maybe with a job or without a job and stuff, but still feeling inside like they're at this 14-year-old developmental stage. And I think the shutdown that goes on in people who stay closeted, no matter what the issue, but we're talking about gay men right now, mm-hmm. I think creates a similar type of thing.
Yes.
That there is such fear that we're living in and such a defensiveness that we're not experiencing life fully in order to develop that openness and the passion for things and the ability to integrate things openly, because if we have a heartbreak, we can't go to mom and dad, or we can't go to siblings and things if we're closeted to help process it. So we isolate and we're alone, and we don't learn that that kind of communication helps us get through our grieving.
Exactly. So we're not integrated, like you say.
Mm-hmm.
You're so right. I agree with that.
And so, you know, and then, of course, you know, it's the whole advertising culture and everything else that just puts all this emphasis on youth. And the truth is, like with society as a whole, the gay community in their 50s and 60s and 70s is increasing because the baby boomers are getting up there, like everything else. So there are gay and lesbian retirement villages opening up now, and all sorts of services. And
yep.
You know, for those of us that survived the ravage of AIDS and stuff, because I believe that there's a whole generation of this age group that, you know, didn't make it to here, that there was a, you know, that there is a special need and a need for a greater consciousness of elders and mentors.
Yes.
That there is a purpose and place for those of us in our 50s and 60s and 40s that is valuable and worthwhile.
Yes, I totally agree.
And I know you deal with another chapter on finding mentors, finding those people who are successful and people you can learn from or emulate.
And I have always done that naturally, mm-hmm. toward older therapists. I don't mean older in terms of age even. I mean, you know, experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I have many gay male friends who are older, and that was always so important to me. And what they always tell me is, very sadly, that they feel that once they turned 50, they started to be looked like they were transparent, like they weren't even there in the gay community. And I just would hear them, and it feels so sad to me because they want to give back. It's just natural as you get older to want to give back. And we don't have children often to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So to want to give back to each other and not be able to is really upsetting to me, which is why I wrote about that in my book.
Do you know who Don Kellhefner is?
No.
He's a therapist in Los Angeles, and he's actually one of the elders of the community here. He helped start the Gay and Lesbian Center back with Morris Kite and Lillian Fifield and others, you know, here in L.A., which is the oldest one in the country. And he works a lot with cross-generational consciousness. And I actually went to a full-day workshop that he did called Standing on the Bones of Our Ancestors. And, and it was about dealing with three generations. It was dealing with younger gays and lesbians who are needing the mentors, and then the middle generation of those of us in our 40s and 50s and early 60s who are the mentors, and then the others above that who are the elders. And it's very apropos to like what Native Americans have in terms of the respect for the elders and the
yes.
passing on of the wisdom, and the younger generation actually looking towards that. And it was a very powerful workshop and a very powerful consciousness.
I saw that advertised, and that looks great. I'm jealous that you got to go. Sounds really nice.
Yeah, he's really rather wonderful. In fact, he was a guest on the show a year ago during Gay Pride, and we talked about the generational differences of coming out. You know, what it was like for those of us in our 50s and 60s or 40s, and what's it like today for people, kids that are coming out when they're 14, 15, 16,
exactly.
and have a different environment and a different culture. So, the other one that I want to touch on today has to do with actually a topic that I've done a number of shows on, and that has to do with sex addiction. In fact, you quote Rob Weiss in here, and Rob's been a guest on the show a couple of times. He's a friend of mine. And there's one thing in particular that you stated that I'm not sure that I agree with, so I'd like to ask you.
Oh, good.
You say most cases of sexual addiction are rooted in childhood sexual abuse, and, well, you go on and often respond to a combination of individual and group therapy, which I believe that's true for sex addiction. But I'm not sure I agree that most cases are rooted in sexual in childhood sexual abuse. Where does that stat come from, or that statement
actually,
come from?
I took that from Patrick Carnes' books and research, where he did polled the people that came into the treatment centers, and one of the questions were you sexually abused? And understanding that it's not just a physical, like an over abuse, it can be an over responsibility, being leaned on, you know, from a parent, being brought into an adult situation emotionally.
So it could be something like covert or
oh, yeah.
a subtle type of non-actual touching, but implied sexual abuse.
Yes, and okay. I didn't touch on this as much as I'm going to touch on it in my next book, because this was something I wanted to expand on, and I say it a little bit in the book. I feel that as a culture, as particularly as gay men, we are covertly sexually assaulted and abused daily.
Mm-hmm.
All you have to do is read the paper, and people aren't upset about gay marriage because we want to love one another. People, if you really get down to it, people are upset about what we do in the bedroom the night before.
Mm-hmm.
That's their focus.
Right.
And so, like, people can hardly even tolerate the concept of a gay child, that children can be gay and lesbian. And the focus, even in the reparative work, is, you know, the people who try to convert from gay to straight, which can't be done, are constantly focused on males. And I guess I would say this to expand on it is that in some ways that is like being sexually abused when you're a child and you're taught that who you are is an abomination and bad and wrong and
mm-hmm.
there's a higher sexual being, and that's heterosexuality, so you're this inferior nothing. That to me contributes to the higher incidence and would be under that thing of sexual abuse.
So it's more it's including the issue of perceived sexual abuse as opposed to just actual sexual abuse.
Absolutely.
In those terms, I can accept that statement then.
So you must see people who have not been sexually abused yet still are sexual addicts. Is that
oh,
right?
Oh yeah. I mean, like I said, I do counseling in the bathhouses, and 60% of the issues that the guys 60% of the guys that come in to actually talk to me, the first question out of their mouth is, how do I know if I'm a sex addict? You know, so it's a very powerful place, actually. It's a very humbling and profound place, actually, to be doing that kind of counseling.
Yeah, I think it's really cool.
Yeah, I really give the owners a lot of kudos for paying a consulting fee to have me there, and they're not required to do it, and that really says something about them. So, we're coming down to the wire here, and we only have a few minutes left. So I want to make sure that, number one, people know how to reach you, and I know that you have a website, which is www.joecort.com. That's JoeKort.com. And they can actually see a lot of the articles you've written on there, workshops, book signing dates that you have coming up, and a whole range of things. And again, I really respect the variety and the range of issues that you really have touched on, especially based on the writings that I see you've done for various periodicals.
Thank you.
Is there anything else you want to make sure the listeners know about you or about?
Well, you know what? The one thing I was hoping that you said there was one last chapter, and I was cringing thinking you were going to skip sexual addiction because most of my reviewers and most of the talk show hosts that I've been on skip it.
Well,
it doesn't even exist.
Well, if you look at my archives, you'll see I've done probably about 6 or 7 shows on it.
Oh,
so
wow.
This is one place where we can talk about it. It's a specialty of mine also, among other addictions, you know, I've even had, you know, done a show with Rob on the internet, the addiction. I don't know if you know that he's written a book
yes.
specific to that, and he's working on a book specific to gay men and sex addiction.
Yes, I know that. Cruise Control. It's going to be
yeah,
great.
Yeah. So no, this is a place where that's talked about very openly because it's not just gay men. It's, you know, across the board, women, gay, straight, men. who are dealing with this issue. I mean, look at Clinton.
I know. <exactly. laughs>
You know, and people won't look at it for what it is. And they're making a judgment that it's a morality thing when really there's an illness going on there.
And I think as a gay culture, often it's just a denial, and that's why I'm not after. Even in some catalogs, they skip that whole chapter as if I didn't even write it when they're promoting the book, and it's just been shocking to me, to be honest mm-hmm. with you. So I appreciate that you brought it up.
Yeah. I mean, there are actually people I mean, you know this, and that there are people in the gay community that are very threatened by the term itself.
Yes.
Because it calls into question their what they feel is a right to have sex wherever and whenever they want without taking any responsibility for the repercussions in their own lives and in society.
Yes, I totally agree.
So I appreciate that, and I know that the other topics go on. We talked about mentors, and actually I would love to have you on again to finish out these chapters because they seem to get more concrete and actually tools, and they get more into relationship and love and partnering and stuff, and I think that's a whole show in itself. So I think what I'd like to do is reschedule you for within the next maybe month and come on and deal with that, because there's so much going on, not just with the marriage issue, but intimacy and relationship issues, which I think is at the cornerstone of a lot of people's issues in therapy.
I agree. I would love it.
Okay, good. Well, with that being said, I think our time is almost up. If any of you didn't get the information on Joe, you know, you can always go to my website, tellthetruthfaster.com. You can email me there. You can get through to Joe there. You'll get the hyperlink to his website there. And if you've missed any of my shows, they're all archived. And within the next week, I'll be totally current on the archives of the last 2 years. So feel free to go and listen and email me. I want to thank you all. I encourage you all to live in your truth and integrity this week, and be willing to change what that looks like. This is Stuart Altshuler and Tell the Truth Faster on KXAM in Phoenix, saying thanks for listening and have a good day. The
thank you for listening to Independent 1310 KXAM, Mesa, Phoenix.
CNN Radio News, I'm Maria Boynton. More threatened beheadings in Iraq. This time the hostages are three Turkish citizens. Our Jana Raff with details.
The hostage takers have placed a 72-hour deadline on Turkey to force to withdraw contractors and other companies supporting the coalition, or it will behead these men. These men holding up what appear to be Turkish passports and, according to the video, saying their names in Turkish.
Alfonso von Marsh telling us now that Turkish officials are trying to figure out more about the status of the three. Turkish